Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, good morning. It's Sunday, the 18th of January, 2009. This is Solder Smoke 99, live from Trastevere, Rome, Italy. Guys, I'm glad to report that La Befana, arrived without difficulty. You may recall I mentioned that La Befana is the friendly witch who brings children in Italy gifts on the sort of the second round of Christmas gift giving. It occurs on the day on the Feast of the Epiphany, and La Befana made it here just fine. The kids got gerbils. We're kind of pet challenged. We're kind of dog people, but we've been living in places where it really wouldn't be practical to have a dog, so we're coming up with sort of compensating pets, and Tyson the cat was the first effort in this direction. Tyson worked out pretty well. Tyson is a British cat. He's moved with us here to Rome, and Tyson doesn't cause too many problems, so I'm pretty happy with Tyson. But I had some misgivings about adding gerbils to the mix, but the kids wanted gerbils, and, well, La Befana came through. And so far, Tyson has not eaten the gerbils, which is a good thing. He seems quite interested, though, and the kids think kindly of Tyson, and I warn them. I say, you know, Tyson, Tyson's going to eat those gerbils. Oh, no, no, Dad, Tyson would never do that. Okay, well, stay tuned. We got a matched pair here, and the kids have, I guess, I suppose I'm responsible for suggesting this, but the names are Dot and Dash. Okay, pretty obvious, yeah. A little bit of Rome travelogue here. One of the things that we did on the Feast of the Epiphany is we went over to the banks of the Tiber River here in Rome, on the banks of the Tevere, near a very historic spot called Castel Sant'Angelo, which is the I believe it's also the tomb of the Emperor Hadrian, and it's very close to the Vatican, right down the road from the Vatican, a big fortress right on the banks of the Tiber. It's really pretty neat. We went in there last year, and you can visit the prison cells and the dungeons that they used to use. Believe me, not a place that you'd like to visit on a long-term basis. This year they have a skating rink kind of between the castle, between the fortress and the river, and ice skating on the banks of the Tiber. Not on the Tiber, that would be a really cold winter, but I understand that they're skating on the canals up in Holland this year, but not quite that cold here in Rome. But they've got the skating rink there, and the kids we got them some skates, and out they went, and that was on the Feast of the Epiphany. And they had this amazing parade in Rome on the day of the Epiphany. We weren't really aware of it, but man, they really did a good job on this. And it happened to be that the skating rink that we were located at was kind of in the path that all the participants in the parade went through after the parade was over. So we got to kind of see the parade close up as it was ending. And the great thing about it was that it really featured hundreds and hundreds of people in medieval costume with medieval weaponry and the crossbows and the battle axes and the whole thing. It was really great, and showed just another reminder of the tremendous creative a talent that exists in this country, and people really into their own the heritage and the and the technologies of the past. Really great stuff. So we really enjoyed that. So we've had a good good holiday season here, and thanks to the Bafana for a very fine business visit here to I0/N2CQR. All right, now to the technical stuff. MEPT Madness, the Beacon Madness continues, and we've had some success here. There's been a lot of new MEPT or QRSS activity in the United States and Canada, and I hope that Solder Smoke's in part responsible for that. But we do see a number of new stations popping up, and we've used the the good offices of Solder Smoke to put at least one transmitter together with receive stations out there. And let's see here. Let me get the appropriate item up on the screen because I want to tell you the story about Eldon's Beacon. Let's see. Yeah, it's Eldon, WA0UWH. I have pictures of his beacon transmitters up on the Blogspot page. The first one is really interesting. He built a little transmitter right on top of a 9-volt Duracell square battery. He built the transmitter there, and if you see the picture on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page, you'll see two wires heading off to either end. That's the loop antenna. Then Eldon got really enthused and built a very nice looking transmitter in a box. Really nice work, a lot of Manhattan style construction. And there's a picture of it on the page. His problem was, and it's the problem that many of us face when we get a rig on the air, is anybody receiving it? And if there's not a lot of online grabbers available kind of within this, that are situated in an area where they would get your signal by a skip, it's hard to tell whether you're on the right frequency where you are. I put out kind of an all-points bulletin on Eldon's Beacon and asked people to see if they could spot it. And lo and behold, just a few days later, Stu, down near Stanford in California, spotted it, took a screenshot, and so we were very happy. I have the screenshot that Stu produced. It's also on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. You can see Eldon's square wave there. One other kind of real happy a circumstance that took place with this reception report. Eldon thought that he was transmitting at 150 milliwatts. It would have been impressive to make it from his QTH up there in the Northwest down to the Stanford area. The path was 723 miles, but when Eldon recalculated, he realized that he was making the trip on 15 milliwatts. Very, very fine business. Great. That's a lot of fun. And thanks to Stu for sending in the reports. I have all the details up on the page. You guys will be able to see Eldon's square wave signal. You can read, if you read along the top, you could read the CW. It's really pretty neat. I also put up on the Blogspot page a proposal. I struggled with the calibration problem with QRSS. The problem is, and it may not seem like a problem to folks who haven't struggled with it, but let me explain. The band, the entire frequency band used for QRSS is only 100 hertz wide. Now, we could fit a lot of signals in that band. We could fit at least 100 signals in that band. The problem is getting your signal in there. If you don't have any really accurate, well-calibrated frequency measuring equipment in the shack, the problem is getting your signal in the band. I struggled with this for a while. I was lucky. I was able to solve the problem, and this gets to my modest proposal for QRSS. The way I solved the problem, I just got lucky. And as I was struggling to get this thing in the band, I came across a regular, ordinary CW Beacon station. It was IK3 NWX, and he's got a standard CW Beacon. And from his website, or from some of the websites describing CW Beacons, I was able to find out that his frequency is 10.141800 megahertz, which is very close to the QRSS band. Not in the band, but close. Close enough so that I could take my receiver, fire up the Argo or Spectran software, put his signal on kind of the bottom of the screen, and then figure out how many hertz I had to move from his signal to be in the QRSS band, and then just adjust, watching the Argo screen, adjust the frequency of my transmitter to put me in the ballpark. And it worked out for me, but I would have been in real difficulty if I didn't have IK3 NWX's standard CW frequency at a standard CW beacon signal at a known and accurate frequency. So my idea was, wouldn't it be useful, given that there's now a number of stations in the U.S. getting into QRSS, at U.S. and Canada, how about if somebody were to set up kind of a frequency standard beacon for QRSS? Ideally, we'd be talking about somebody who was kind of out in the Great Plains, somebody whose signal would skip to both the East and West Coast, where, let's face it, most of our stations probably are. The idea would be that if somebody were to be able to transmit very accurately a standard CW beacon, not a QRSS beacon, but something on standard CW with a bit of power. And when I'm talking a bit of power, I don't think we need anything more than 5 watts. In the QRSS world, that's really high power. But transmit this standard beacon on that on a frequency kind of close to the edge of the QRSS band, and this would allow people to do with that beacon what I did with the Italian beacon NWX that I found. I think it might be an easy way to help stations overcome the calibration problem. It wouldn't have to be the kind of thing that would have to be on all the time, and maybe just we could set up a couple of weekends where it would be on, and folks who needed to calibrate it or could use it, or it could be turned on on an as needed basis. But it would help out. I got an idea, and I'm going to put this up on the blog. If somebody else sent in an idea, said and pointed out that in the States, you know, with WWV at 10 and 15 megahertz, there's a way you could use those very accurate frequency standards to, in effect, calibrate even simple receivers to allow you to get your frequency in the ballpark. So that might be another idea. My mid-continent beacon station might not actually be necessary given WWV, especially WWV at 10 megahertz. The guy, and I want to give him credit, but I don't have his email in front of me right now. But the idea was he had just one of these little Sony shortwave receivers with a digital readout. He used that receiver in conjunction with WWV and the Argo software. He put the receiver on 9999 kilohertz upper sideband, tuned in WWV and adjusted kind of the RIT control until the signal showed at precisely 1000 hertz on Argo. So he then switched to the WWV frequency at 15 megahertz, I think going 14999 upper sideband. and without moving the RIT control, noted how far off the signal was for how far it was from the 1,000 hertz that it should be showing. This gave him a little bit of an idea of the skew, and then he was able to go to 10,140 into that range and adjust his transmitter. He said that using this technique, he was able to get within 10 hertz of where he wanted to be. So that's pretty good. So that might be an easier way to get the calibration problem taken care of. But anyway, we'll continue to look at that, and I think a lot of people are having a lot of fun with QRSS. You know, if you're listening to this thinking that this is all really kind of high-tech digital computer stuff, I'd say think again. On the receive side, that's where all the digital wizardry takes place in the Argo and Spectran software that most people are using. On the transmit side, this is really simple QRPP CW. Most of us are using key ears from K1EL and other vendors to generate the signal, but there are even simpler ways to generate the QRSS signal. I imagine you could do it with a tape recorder, an old tape recorder, sort of in one of these constant loop modes. That would be a way of doing it. I guess there's also mechanical ways. All you need to do is have something generate the signal in QRSS kind of beacon mode. So on the transmit side, this is really low-tech stuff, and I think it's very much the essence of QRP. We're talking real low-level power, it's a good cooperative effort too, because there does need to be a cooperation between the transmit stations and the grabbers out there. The more online grabbers we have, the better. It's great fun to be able to, from wherever you are, just log on to one of those websites and see your signal arriving in different parts of the world. Hans Sommer's G0 UPL has recently been back on QRSS from London, and he pointed out on his website that occasionally he takes a peek at the grabber pages from work. I've mentioned that I can check them from my BlackBerry. I think that's a lot of fun. I'll be on a bus in London, and not in London, in Rome now, and be going along on the bus and just decide, hey, I wonder if my 50 milliwatt signal is making it up to ON5EX's grabber up there in Belgium, and I'll just pull the thing out. I have it on the bookmark page, and I'll see my signal, my little 50 milliwatt square wave, arriving to Johan's receiver there in Belgium. Now this brings us to a story. I guess I'm calling it a tale of two grabbers. There are two grabbers up there in the Benelux countries: ON5EX Johan's and Peter's Papa Alpha 1 Sierra Delta Bravo. I'm very grateful to both these radio amateurs for keeping these online grabbers in operation. I use them almost every day. Sometimes I'm really strong into one of them and not visible at all in the other, or vice versa. It's usually the ON5EX grabber that I'm most consistently visible on. But sometimes I won't be visible there, but then I'll be visible in Peter's PA1SDB's grabber. I used the distance calculator on the very nice Copacetic Flow website, and it reports that I'm 756 miles from Johan's receiver and 832 miles from Peter's. So not a real big difference in distance, but it's really surprising sometimes how I'm strong into one and then and not into the other, and vice versa. Watching on and off the my signal arriving in these grabbers, it's a demonstration of how useful QRSS is for keeping an eye on what's happening with propagation. These days, it's almost clockwork. I have my beacon on. It's on right now. As a matter of fact, I should. There you go. I'll let it run a little bit. You can probably hear it in the background. You'll hear how long the dots and dashes are. Anyway, it's almost like clockwork because my signal will start to appear, and it'll appear very suddenly in ON5EX's grabber just about exactly 1 hour after sunrise. And his sunrise and my sunrise, it's not a lot of time difference now. He's further to the north, but it's not that much of a difference. As I watch the line on the sun map go across our QTHs, just about 1 hour later, boom, my signal's there. It'll be there fairly solid all day. And then as the sun goes down, almost as if the sundown line goes past us, boom, it's gone. My signal just drops. It drops like a rock. And so it's kind of interesting to watch the sunrise, sunset thing going on here with QRSS. Let me turn off the side tone monitor. I have a little switch that lets me turn off the side tone because it drives everybody in the house crazy if they hear this beeping going on all day. Now, one of the interesting things also is to listen to, let me turn around the Drake 2B, put the Drake 2B on frequency here. Let me let you guys listen to the actual signal. And you'll hear how you can, it's almost impossible to hear the modulation. I mean, the modulation, the difference, it's FSK modulation. And the difference between key up and key down is, there I am. The difference between key up and key down is 5 hertz. So it sounds, if anybody's listening to it, if you just tuned in my signal, it's almost imperceptible. Yeah, you can hear a little bit there, a little bit if you listen carefully. Hold on. Yeah, you hear it? Very, very slight. I mean, if you didn't know what this was, you wouldn't. Let's listen to it again. Hold on. See how good your hearing is. If you can detect the 5 hertz difference. There you go. Anyway, enough of that. Great fun with QRPP and QRSS, and you know, you get involved in long distance monitoring here. On January 6th, I was watching an online grabber, the online grabber in Tasmania of VK7KRW, and I was watching my friend Alan's signal, signal of Alan VK2ZAY. His signal was crossing the Tasman Sea down there to I think he's in the Sydney area down to Tasmania. And then yesterday I was just kind of looking at the grabbers online, and I was looking at the grabber of VK6DI over there in Perth on the west coast of Australia. He's got a very good grabber, a very important grabber station for us. And just as the sun was going down over Western Australia, I started seeing the signals of Colin, G6AVK, start to appear on the VK6DI grabber machine. And so I shot Colin an email, told him that he was that his signal was making it into VK6DI. It's kind of interesting. Colin was a bit. Kind of, I guess he kind of reluctantly told me that he was running a full 1 watt. in QRSS circles, that's considered really almost distastefully high powered. So he was being honest and said that, well, he made the trip to VK6, but it was with a full watt. So Colin, I thought, was saying that it really wasn't such a big deal. It is great fun. Last night there were on the mailing list of the Knights group, the Knights with a K, the Knights of the not the Knights of the Round Table, but the Knights of the QRSS. There was a message from Northern Utah, and somebody had picked up on their receive system just a fragment of some FSK. It was obviously an FSK signal, but he only got a little bit of it, and we were all trying to figure out what it was. And I was looking at it and looking at it and looking at it, and just before I went to bed, I realized that it was, I was looking at the last bit of Eldon's call sign and the first few characters of his grid square. So I was happy to sort of crack the code and solve the mystery, and I put out an email message to everybody saying that this was yet another reception report for Eldon's new 15 milliwatt beacon. Very, very, very interesting stuff. All right, I guess that closes the MEPT QRSS portion of this week's show. Just wanted to mention, I don't know if you guys do this, but I really recommend it. I rarely leave the house without stuffing into my coat pocket at least one or two copies of Sprat, and I have them all on the shelf here, and my selection process is very random. I just reach in there and grab one or two, and then as the family moves around Rome, when you get to these inevitable moments where you have to wait, and you guys know what I'm talking about, sometimes you have to wait, you just have a Sprat ready there. And so when the kids were ice skating, and listen, I've reached this point in life where I know that I should no longer be ice skating. Not that I was ever really into it, but it's just not a good idea. I was watching some guys out there on that skating rink who were about my age making some really spectacular falls, and I said, nope, that was a bad decision there. So I let the kids ice skate, and this lets me stand off to the side there next to the Tiber River and read Sprat. And you know, it's one of the beautiful things about Sprat is that it's such a time machine. You know, these it's been going out for more than 20, 25 years now, and more than that, and so you're getting great ideas from the past, and as you're, the random selection that you make as you walk out the door can bring you back way back. And in my case, it brought me back to, let me see, I've got the issue here. I had on the day of the Epiphany, as I stood by the Tiber River, Sprat issue number 56 from autumn 1988, with a very fine photograph from the Rochdale Observer of G3 RJV operating from St. Alden's Church Tower. Very interesting picture of George there with a very fine business station and a Tentec rig. Very nice. Some homebrew gear visible up on the top. But the article that really caught my eye was from Robert van der Zaal, Papa Alpha 3, Bravo Hotel Kilo. And it's a really neat little article it says here, I'll just read you the opening paragraph. In direct conversion receivers, factory-made Schottky diode mixers like the SBL-1 and the MD-108 are commonly used. Although they are very reliable devices, they have one disadvantage. They are too expensive for a student's purse. So I looked for an alternative and found some from Dutch magazines that it was possible to make. Klaus, PA0KSB, gave his views on the subject in Electron magazine, and one The local radio amateur magazine at the university suggested practical methods. All right, so then we have this article here in which Robert describes his efforts to sort of reproduce the four-diode two-transformer configuration of the SBL1. Very, very nice article. And it reminded me also that I had also been reading another article by Robert, and I mentioned this in Solder Smoke a few episodes back, of his very inspirational article on an 80-meter DSB rig that he built while he was a kid in school. So I thought we should reach out and thank Robert for those articles from long ago. I checked on the net. He's still active, still on the air. His call sign now is Papa Alpha 9 Radio Zulu. So thanks to you, Robert, for the great articles. Another episode in which Spratt saved me from boredom and desperation occurred outside a knitting store, a yarn store. You know it. You guys know what I'm talking about. My wife had to go in there and get some supplies for her her creative activities, and no big deal. Billy and I were waiting out there on the street, and I decided it was a moment for Spratt. And I reached into my pocket, and I pulled it out, and it just happened to be that I had with me Spratt number 52, I guess from 1987 or so, and it was amazing because I had it kind of folded open, and I pulled it out of my pocket. I looked at it, and there was an article written by Wes, W7ZOI, called "An Alternative Portable Antenna," and I said, "Billy, look, this article's by Wes." And so we kind of read through it and talked about it a little bit right there on the street near Campo di Fiori in central Rome. So I guess the lesson, guys, is that when you write something for Spratt, you're helping radio amateurs not just of today, but perhaps 10, 20 years from now. So again, thanks to the authors and thanks to the guys who put out Spratt. Okay. Now, I guess we're talking about reading material, so I can mention this book I've been telling you about, Empire of the Air. Empire of the Air by Tom Lewis. You know, it was a PBS special. I forget the guy. Was it Ken Burns who did all the Civil War movies? He also did the video on this one. The video was quite good. I really enjoyed it. And had it. The book is also very good. It's by Tom Lewis, and it's a really, really good history of radio broadcasting in the United States, and it's a really good biography of three of the main participants: Armstrong, DeForest, and Sarnoff. I'm discovering, though, that the weak point of the book, and I don't want to make too much of it because it is a really interesting book, and I think you guys would like it. The weak part is on the technical side. I did a little Googling, and I found out that Tom Lewis, who's a superb writer, of course, and wonderful historian, great biographer here, he's not a tech guy. Tom does not have the knack, and it's obvious. Neither do his editors have the knack, because some of the stuff that the technical observations that made it into the book really almost cause a knack victim, someone knowledgeable on this stuff to just kind of groan. Let me read you one. They're describing the use of Fleming's tubes as radio, as detectors in radio receivers. And the quote from the book: "The electrons liberated by Marconi's spark gap transformer imperceptibly traveled through the air at the speed of light. Gadzooks! Now they could be captured and converted into direct current through the agency of a small filament and plate in a little glass tube." Holy cow. Marconi's spark gap shooting electrons into the air. The electrons fly around the world, fly into the little glass tube. Holy cow, that's a... Well, of course, that's not what happens. That's the problem. Also, on the next page, they seem to have been hit with a bout of kind of technical goofiness. But they're talking about the moment when DeForest placed a grid in the vacuum tube. And it says here, when this wire was positively charged, DeForest found it would attract the stream of positive electrons flowing from the filament, accelerate them, and send them toward the plate and the more positive charge. And then there's discussion here in which it becomes apparent that the author, there's a lot of discussion of both positive and negative electrons. Anyway, again, I don't want to make too much of it because you shouldn't read it as a technical book. So I mean, this is Tom Lewis. It's not Terman. it's Empire of the Air. It's not EMRFD or the ARRL handbook. So read it as such. But I'm really enjoying it. The people they're very, very interesting people, and you come up with stuff. You get a sense of the time. You could see things that are just so totally different from the way things work today, but then you can see similarities. You could see a lot of similarities between the kind of the radio financial craze and the dot-com balloon and the balloon burst. At one point, they're discussing how one of the companies that was set up with DeForest was operating radio stations, but they were all operating at a loss. Even the shipboard stations, they looked at it and they were all losing money. And they came to the conclusion that they really didn't care about that because what they were all they were concerned about was running up the stock price. So it was sort of a bubble factory. Also, I mean, just little tidbits. When Armstrong came home from World War One, he arrived at his parents' house with a bloody bandage on his head, and he didn't get shot or anything, but on his way home, he contracted an anthrax infection on his scalp. Holy cow! You know, he picked it up in I think in the port in France that they shipped out of, and so he came home with. Well, I guess there's no other kind of anthrax infection, but a really nasty anthrax infection on his scalp. Ouch, I didn't know about that. Anyway, all kinds of great details and discussion of the time, the excitement that came with the development of radio. I was also struck by how, gentlemen, we're now joined by the lovely and talented Maria Patricia.
Hi.
All right, just woke up. Got a big warm blanket wrapped around her. It's kind of cold here in Rome this morning. Maria's 8 years old, first one up after me. Anyway, it's also obvious when you read the book how the idea of radio broadcasting, which seems to us like a complete no-brainer, was not a no-brainer way back when. And people had gotten so used to the idea of radio as just a point-to-point a system for transmitting written messages in Morse code that the idea that you would use it to transmit entertainment to the masses was quite new. Sarnoff in the Marconi Company was writing memos outlining this idea as early as 1915, and he was outlining there's one memo, I think it was probably the first one, in which he kind of outlines a business plan for radio broadcasting, and he notes that if this is done, people would be interested in buying what he called a radio music box because it would allow them, it would replace in the home both the piano and the wind-up Victrola. And he had to put it on the shelf for a while because of a variety of business reasons. But then they came back, and then I guess starting around 1920 with KDKA and other stations, radio broadcasting kind of kicked in the United States. It's a reminder for me how new this all is. I mean, my father was born in 1925, and that was right around the time that radio broadcasting was just getting going. So we're still talking about a very new technology. Empire of the Air by Tom Lewis, 4 stars from Solder Smoke. The only reason it didn't get 5 is because of the electrons flying through the air from Marconi's transmitter to the receiver. But I recommend it, and it's a good book. What else we got? Alpha 1, Tango Juliet. The Hero of the Hobbit Hole, the Poet Laureate of QRP, the CFL, the Compact Fluorescent Light Bulb Revolution continues and has reached the shores of Cuba. Arnie Coro sent in to QRPL some comments on Michael's CFL rig, and Arnie makes the observation that this is the kind of gear that could make a big difference for radio amateurs in developing countries who don't have a lot of parts, a lot of resources. If these bulbs make it near them, the circuits that use these bulbs could be used to put them on the air. So some interesting comments there from Arnie, as always. Michael now has a receiver to accompany the derelict CFL light bulb transmitter. And Michael has actually moved on to another project called the Reggie. It's named for somebody who appears in Empire of the Air quite frequently, Reginald Fessenden, the guy who brought us the first phone broadcasts on Christmas Eve. Was it Christmas Eve 1906? I think so. Anyway, Michael's got a comment that really made me laugh on his website describing the Reggie, and I'll try to put a link to this up on the Blogspot page. The Reggie is a 1-transistor, 80-meter QRP transceiver designed for the minimalist. Not only does it transmit small signals, but the receiver converts every signal on the band to QRP. Think of that, guys. Not only is your transmitter QRP, but with the Reggie, you've got a receiver that makes every signal on the band a QRP signal. Holy cow. Michael, you got a future in marketing. you would have been great back in the day, back there with Sarnoff and DeForest and Armstrong. Thanks for sending that to us, Michael. A few things about what we have on the blog. We moved to soldersmoke.blogspot.com page moved to a new 3-column format. The old format that I was using felt kind of restricted, kind of narrow. So I went out onto the web and found a new format. Some fella in Indonesia designed it, put it together, made it available for free. So thanks to him, there's credits to him on the bottom of the page. We have up on the blog this week a very fine business video from Jeff Dam, WA7MLH. About a year ago, Jeff did a video on what kind of rigs he has on his operating table and what kind of test gear he's using. Really interesting stuff. I think you'll love it. These rigs are beautiful in an ugly kind of way, and you guys know what I mean. A short article there on the Mars rovers, 5 years on the red planet. They were supposed to work 90 days. They're operating now 5 years. One of them has to drive backwards. They've got a variety of aches and pains, but they take a licking and keep on ticking. So kudos to the folks at NASA and JPL who put those little cars on Mars. Related to astronomy, I have a little article on the International Year of Astronomy 2009. It's been 400 years since Galileo did his thing with the telescope. Observe the satellites of Jupiter and the craters on the moon, and there's a movement afoot, a worldwide movement to expose more people to the joys of astronomy, and they're urging everybody with a telescope to get out and let 100 people look through their telescope. So we're thinking about doing something similar here, something along those lines in Trastevere. Take out our 6-inch Dobsonian. Let some of the folks take a look. One of the problems right now is that there's nothing really spectacular up in the evening sky. Venus is up there, but it's not really much to look at. Jupiter is in the sun right now, so it's not visible at night. And Saturn rises, but it's real early in the morning. And I'm not sure that I want to have the telescope out there on the piazza at 5 a.m. I'd be reaching a very unusual, very unscientific demographic. That'd probably be a group more interested in chemistry than astronomy. Also have on the blog a link to an interview with Harold Beveridge of the Beveridge Antenna fame. Great interview, really. He had contact and worked with some of the greats of radio, and he talks about all of them. Very nice interview. I've got the story of Eldon's Beacon that I mentioned earlier in the show. KD1JV has a really interesting surface mount video on how to do surface mount soldering. I'm sure that you'll all find it interesting, if not a bit disturbing. It's a long way from the kind of soldering that we're used to, but it seems to be the way of the future. So get out those cooking pans and those hair dryers and get ready to do surface mount soldering. Check out the video. Got a little article on QRSS calibration. Another wonderful video, N0TU, came up and finally put together his straight kenite video. We had the trailer on there. This thing gets 5 stars, really great, top-notch video for radio amateurs, homebrewers, and knack victims. You guys will really like this. And finally, I have VE7 BPU's digital logic page. Hold on a second. Let me make sure I got that right. This guy's a very important contributor to, let's see. VE7BPO. What am I saying? Wrote the call sign down there wrong. Todd, VE7BPO. He's the guy who runs the QRPPops.net page that many of us have been using for a long time. He's got a great page up there about his work with digital logic. And he goes the extra mile and homebrews his own numerical displays. No simple store-bought 7-segment displays for Todd. He goes the extra mile and rolls his own with individual LEDs. So, great. Thanks. And I hope you guys visit the blog and enjoy it. And that brings us, what do we do now, Maria, on the show? Well, now we do, what do you call that?
I don't know.
Solder smoke. Well, let's see. Hold on. Stand by.
Time for...
Mailbag.
Indeed.
Yeah, solder smoke mailbag. First email we got was from Raghav, VU3VWR in Chennai. He says that he's been a victim of the knack since the 9th grade. He's built rigs for 2 meters and 40 meters. He's interested in QRSS, but wonders if it's allowed in India. Don't know. Can't help you with the legal aspects of it there, Raghav, but I hope it is, and I hope we get some Indian stations into the QRSS universe. Thanks for the email. Nick, M0NJP, he likes the show and says that he has finally gotten used to my my voice, which apparently he had some problems with in the beginning. He is a bit uneasy with what he terms solder smoke's capitalism, but he was kind enough to ask about how he could reach the Amazon.com page via the UK. I put a link up there, and I noted that you guys can help out with solder smoke's finances by buying your by making all your Amazon.com purchases through a link on the blog page. For those of you outside the United States who want to contribute, just scroll down to the bottom of the page click on the link, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and you'll find links to Amazon in your home country. So thanks to Nick for the support. Brian, VK3HXR, comments on his EPC, the little web notebook that Billy has, and he's running Ubuntu, a version of Linux, on it. Thanks for that, Brian. Paolo, IK1ZYW, writes from snowy Turin up there in Torino in northern Italy. A lot of snow up there this year. And he said one of his projects, he's got a new blog on. It's called it's IK1ZYW.blogspot.com. I checked it out. It's a very nice nice blog page you guys should visit. He has designed an external keypad for the Foxtango 817, and he has a small stock of programmed chips, already pre-programmed chips, available for this external keypad, and he has them available at cost for fellow NAC victims. So if you're interested in that, get in touch with Paolo, and Paolo, thanks for sending in the email. Tony Fishpool, our good friend back in the UK, G4WIF of the GQRP Club, has come through once again and is sending me a 4019 chip to replace the bad chip in my frequency counter that I talked about in the last episode. So thanks very much for the chip and for the words of encouragement, Tony, and for your work on Sprat and the GQRP Club over the years. It's particularly appropriate that this chip come to me from a friend in the UK, because I picked up the counter. The counter is I picked it up at the Kempton Park rally in London. I think during the visit to the rally in which Tony and I met up. So I'm really, really glad that he's going to send the chip along, and as soon as it comes here, I'll pop it in and get that frequency counter functioning as it was originally intended to. Meant to mention, and this is a good point to mention it, we should all be grateful to another guy out there, Forrest Mims. You know, when I was trying to figure out how this frequency counter works and why it wasn't working, I went over to the bookshelf here and found one of those little books that they used to sell in Radio Shack. I don't know if they still do, you know, those little engineer notebooks. I think I have the whole collection here. They're by Forrest Mims, and it really helped me understand what was going on with the AND gates and the NAND gates and the JK flip-flops. So kudos to Forrest Mims, a guy who's made a really tremendous contribution to the radio art and the radio literature over the years. Very successful writer, and I've always been a real big fan of Forrest's work. Got a nice email from an old friend, Jim, AL7RV. Jim, as the call sign indicates, moves around in an RV. He's a very very talented engineer and designer himself, and he said that one of the more recent episodes of Solder Smoke caused him to laugh so hard that his wife was afraid that he was having some sort of a fit. What particularly got Jim going was my very careful description of the proper sequence of designing and building. I said, you know, you really have to be careful. Design, build. For many years, I and I think many of you have gotten the sequence wrong, and we just got going with the building and didn't mess with the designing. But Jim was pleased to hear that that I'm changing my evil ways, and apparently got a kick out of the about the proper sequence here. So good to hear from you, Jim. West W7ZOI wrote in and helped me out with the different ways that feedback networks are drawn. Wes it's really great to have Wes as a mentor. Somebody will take the time to write, and he always gives really thoughtful and careful responses whenever we mention a technical problem here, and really squared me away and made me understand that there's no real essential difference in the way in which the feedback diagrams are drawn. Joe Rocchi has been working on coming up with an LT SPICE model for the NE602 chip, and he's got one. I've got some technical problems here on the computer related to unzipping files and stuff that have prevented me from looking at it, but I'm going to look at it. I'm going to try to look at it today or tomorrow. We're off tomorrow, American holiday. So, Joe, I promise to try to look at it tomorrow, and I hope you'll give me permission to share it with the solder smoke community, because I think it's one of the LT Spice models that we really need to have in the arsenal. And thanks for your work on that. Thanks for sending it along, and we'll get the word out to the solder smoke community. Jerry, Echo India 8, Delta Radio Bravo, he sent me a question, and you know, I don't know why you asked, Jerry. I don't know why. Why would you ask me this question? The question is, should I buy a Drake 2B or with a Drake 2BQ? Should I buy the Drake 2B and the 2BQ? He asks me this question. I mean, you know, what did you expect me to say, Jerry? Of course you should buy the Drake 2B and the Drake 2BQ. Everyone should have one. There should be a Drake 2B in the home of every radio amateur, perhaps in the home of every person. I don't think there are enough, so we'll just say in the home of every radio amateur. I strongly recommend that Jerry make the purchase, and he's followed my advice, so there will soon be a Drake 2B and a 2BQ in the shack. I told him, I said, you know, you got to realize that you're going back in time a bit. You're going back to the mid-1960s. We're not talking about glowing numerals here. We're talking about a frequency readout in which an actual string is involved, and that you may have to replace that string from time to time. You may actually become good at Drake 2B string replacement, as I have become. But it's well worth it, and I pointed out that many of the real receiver gurus often cite the 2B as the standard to which they aspire. So anyway, good luck with the 2B. I know I didn't steer you wrong. I'm sure you'll be happy with it, Jerry. Thanks for writing. All right, Steve Snort Rosin Smith writes in to comment on the video of Steve Melt Solder KD1JV. I mentioned this earlier when I was talking about the blog. Steve Melt Solder KD1JV is somebody who we've been privileged to read about and work with for the community has been working with him and taking advantage of his good work for many years. He produced. He went into the video age and produced the video that I described earlier on surface mount soldering. It's up on the Blogspot page. Now, Steve Snort Rosin Smith writes in on this video, and continuing with his theme of evaluating the aromas of various forms of solder, he has become the connoisseur of solder smoke. And has taken an approach to this topic similar to that used by people who evaluate fine wines. Steve says that a surface mount solder paste lacks the fine aroma of a true rosin core. Thank you for that, Steve, and we'll put that on the list of reasons to be uneasy about the whole surface mount thing. I know it's coming. I know this is the wave of the future. I know that we've got to move into it. I know we can't be dinosaurs. We can't be like those guys who wrote Spark Forever on their QSL cards and resisted the move to CW. I know we'll all be surface mounted and probably going even smaller in the future. But you know what I mean. I don't know. I don't know. We'll have to struggle with this a bit. Finally, we got a great message from Craig, KC2LFI. Craig took a break from seeing patients, like medical patients, to help me with my sibilant S problem. You guys know what I'm talking about. We've taken care of the popping P problem, but the sibilant S problem has been hanging in there. We want to fix it. Anyway, Craig took a break from medical duties and to think about this, and has taken a look at the spectrum, the audio spectrum of your typical solder smoke broadcast. He notices that the S's pop up at around 3,500 hertz, and recommends that that's the kind of notch filter provisions in the equalization program that comes with Audacity to see if we could notch out the sibilant S's. So I will write it now. I will surely try to use the notch filter to knock out the sibilant S's that sometimes appear in solder smoke. There, I guess that's the portion where I'll do the experiment. So you guys tell me if solder smoke is a little bit less S-y with the notch filter. Thanks for sending that in, Craig. Guys, that brings us to the one-hour mark, more or less. That's the end of Solder Smoke 99. I hope you liked it. Hope the new year is going good for you. I know it's a tough one. Hang in there, and I hope things get better during 2009. 7-3 from Rome.